Travis waved, as if he had not been sitting there under a leaden blanket of fear. Einstein went to the garage to greet her, and a minute later, they both reappeared. She was wearing blue jeans and a yellow and white checkered shirt, but Travis thought she looked good enough to waltz onto a dance floor among begowned and bejeweled princesses. She came to him, leaned down, kissed him. Her lips were warm. She said, "Miss me terribly?" "With you gone, there was no sun, no trilling from the birds, no joy." He tried to say it flippantly, but it came out with an underlying note of seriousness. Einstein rubbed against her and whined to get her attention, then peered up at her and woofed softly, as if to say, "Well?" "He's right," Travis said. "You're not being fair. Don't keep us in suspense."
"I am," she said.
"You are?" She grinned.
"Knocked up."
"Oh my," he said.
"Preggers, with child, in a family way, a mother to be."
He got up and put his arms around her, held her close and kissed her, and said, "Dr. Weingold couldn't be mistaken." And she said, "No, he's a good doctor." And Travis said, "He must have told you when." And she said, "We can expect the baby the third week of June." And Travis said stupidly, "Next June?" And she laughed and said, "I don't intend to carry this baby for a whole extra year." And finally, Einstein insisted on having a chance to nuzzle her and express his delight.
"I brought home a chilled bottle of bubbly to celebrate," she said,
thrusting a paper bag into his hands. In the kitchen, when he took the bottle out of the bag, he saw that it was sparkling apple cider, non-alcoholic. He said, "Isn't this a celebration worth the best champagne?" Getting glasses from a cupboard, she said, "I'm probably being silly, a world champion warrior, but I'm taking no chances, Travis. I never thought I'd have a baby, never dared dream it, and now I've got this hinky feeling that I was never meant to have it, and that it's going to be taken away from me if I don't take every precaution, if I don't do everything just right. So I'm not taking another drink until it's born. I'm not going to eat too much red meat, and I'm going to eat more vegetables. I never have smoked, so that's not a worry. I'm going to gain exactly as much weight as Dr. Weingold tells me I should, and I'm going to do my exercises, and I'm going to have the most perfect baby the world has ever seen." "Of course you are," he said, filling their wine glasses with sparkling apple cider and pouring some in a dish for Einstein.
"Nothing will go wrong," she said.
"Nothing," he said. They toasted the baby and Einstein, who was going to make a terrific godfather, uncle, grandfather, and furry guardian angel. Nobody mentioned the outsider. Later that night, in bed in the dark, after they had made love and were just holding each other, listening to their hearts beating in unison, he dared to say, "Maybe with what might be coming our way, we shouldn't be having a baby just now."
"Hush," she said.
"But
we didn't plan for this baby," she said.
"In fact, we took precautions against it.
But it happened anyway.
There's something special about the fact that it happened in spite of all our careful precautions, don't you think? In spite of all I said before about maybe not being meant to have it?
Well, that's just the old Nora talking.
The new Nora thinks we were meant to have it, that it's a great gift to us, as Einstein was. But considering what may be coming, that doesn't matter," she said. "We'll deal with that. We'll come out of that all right. We're ready. And then we'll have the baby and really begin our life together. I love you, Travis."
"I love you," he said. "God, I love you."
He realized how much she had changed from the mousy woman he'd met in Santa Barbara last spring. Right now, she was the strong one, the determined one, and she was trying to allay his fears. She was doing a good job, too. He felt better. He thought about the baby, and he smiled in the dark, with his face buried in her throat. Though he now had three hostages to fortune, Nora, the unborn baby, and Einstein, he was in finer spirits than he had been in longer than he could remember. Nora had allayed his fears. Part 2. Vince Nasco sat in an elaborately carved Italian chair with a deep glossy finish that had acquired its remarkable transparency only after a couple of centuries of regular polishing. To his right was a sofa and two more chairs, and a low table of equal elegance, arranged before a backdrop of bookcases filled with leather-bound volumes that had never been read. He knew that they had never been read because Mario Tetragna, whose private study this was, had once pointed to them with pride and said, "Expensive books, and as good as the day they were made because they've never been read. Never. Not a one." In front of him was the immense desk at which Mario Tetragna reviewed earnings reports from his managers, issued memos about new ventures, and ordered people killed. The Don was at that desk now, overflowing his leather chair, eyes closed. He looked as if he was dead of clogged arteries and a fat, impacted heart, but he was only considering Vince's request. Mario, the screwdriver Tetragna, respected patriarch of his immediate blood family, much-feared Don of the broader Tetragna family that controlled drug traffic, gambling, prostitution, loan-sharking, pornography, and other organized criminal activity in San Francisco, was a 5-foot-7-inch, 300-pound tub with a face as plump and greasy and smooth as an overstuffed sausage casing. It was hard to believe that this rotund specimen could have built an infamous criminal operation. True, Tetragna had been young once, but even then he would have been short, and he had the look of a man who'd been fat all his life. His pudgy, stubby-fingered hands reminded Vince of a baby's hands, but they were the hands that ruled the family's empire. When Vince had looked into Mario Tetragna's eyes, he instantly realized that the Don's stature and his all-too-evident decadence were of no importance. The eyes were those of a reptile, flat, cold, hard, watchful. If you weren't careful, if you displeased him, he would hypnotize you with those eyes and take you the way a snake would take a mesmerized mouse. He would choke you down whole and digest you. Vince admired Tetragna. He knew this was a great man, and he wished he could tell the Don that he, too, was a man of destiny. But he had learned never to speak of his immortality, for in the past such talk had earned him ridicule from a man he'd thought would understand. Now Don Tetragna opened his reptilian eyes and said, "Let me be certain I understand. You are looking for a man. This is not family business. It is a private grudge."
"Yes, sir," Vince said.
"You believe this man may have bought counterfeit papers and may be living under a new name. He would know how to obtain such papers, even though he is not a member of any family, not of the Fratellanza."
"Yes, sir. His background is such that he would know."
"And you believe he would have obtained these papers in either Los Angeles or here?"
Don Tetragna said, gesturing toward the window in the city of San Francisco with one soft pink hand.
Vince said, "On August 25th, he went on the run, starting from Santa Barbara by car, because for various reasons he couldn't take a plane anywhere. I believe he would have wanted a new identity as quickly as he could get it. At first, I assumed he'd go south and seek out counterfeit ID in Los Angeles, because that was closest. But I've spent the better part of 2 months talking with all the right people in L.A., Orange County, and even San Diego, all the people to whom this man could have gone for high-quality false ID, and I've had a few leads, but none panned out. So if he didn't go south from Santa Barbara, he came north. And the only place in the north where he could get the kind of quality papers he would want is in our fair city," Don Tetragna said, gesturing again toward the window and smiling at the populous slopes below. Vince supposed that the Don was smiling fondly at his beloved San Francisco. But the smile didn't look fond. It looked avaricious.
"And," Don Tetragna said, "you would like for me to give you the names of the people who have my authorization to deal in papers such as this man needed.
If you can see it in your heart to grant me this favor, I would be most grateful."
"They won't have kept records."
"Yes, sir, but they might remember something."
"They're in the business of not remembering."
"But the human mind never forgets, Don Tetragna. No matter how hard it tries, it never really forgets."
"How true. And you swear that the man you seek is not a member of any family?"
"I swear it."
"This execution must not in any way be traced to my family?"
"I swear it." Don Tetragna closed his eyes again, but not for as long as he had closed them before. When he opened them, he smiled broadly, but as always, it was a humorless smile. He was the least jolly fat man Vince had ever seen.
"When your father married a Swedish girl rather than one of his own people, his family despaired and expected the worst.
but your mother was a good wife, unquestioning and obedient, and they produced you, a most handsome son. But you're more than handsome. You're a good soldier, Vincent. You have done fine, clean work for the families in New York and New Jersey, for those in Chicago, and also for us on this coast. Not very long ago, you did me the great service of crushing the cockroach Pentangela, for which you paid me most generously, Don Tetragna. The screwdriver waved one hand dismissively. We're all paid for our labors. But we're not talking money here. Your years of loyalty and good service are worth more than money. Therefore, you are owed at least this one favor.
Thank you, Don Tetragna.
You'll be given the names of those who provide such papers in this city, and I'll see that they are all forewarned of your visit. They'll cooperate fully.
If you say they will, Vince said, rising and bowing, with only his head and shoulders. I know that it is true.
The Don motioned him to sit down. But before you attend to this private affair, I'd like you to take another contract. There's a man in Oakland who is giving me much grief. He thinks I can't touch him because he's politically well-connected and well-guarded. His name is Ramon Velasquez. This will be a difficult job, Vincent.
Vince carefully concealed his frustration and displeasure. He did not want to take on a troublesome hit right now. He wanted to concentrate on tracking down Travis Cornell and the dog. But he knew Tetragna's contract was more a demand than an offer. To get the names of the people who sold false papers, he must first waste Velasquez. He said, I would be honored to squash any insect that has stung you, and there'll be no charge this time.
Oh, I'd insist on paying you, Vincent.
As ingratiatingly as he knew how, Vince smiled and said, Please, Don Tetragna, let me do this favor. It would give me great pleasure. Tetragna appeared to consider the request, though this was what he expected, a free hit in return for helping Vince. He put both hands on his enormous belly and patted himself.
I am such a lucky man. Wherever I turn, people want to do me favors, kindnesses.
Not lucky, Don Tetragna, Vince said, sick of their mannered conversation. You reap what you sow, and if you reap kindness, it is because of the seeds of greater kindnesses you've sown so broadly. Beaming, Tetragna accepted his offer to waste Velasquez for nothing. The nostrils of his porcine nose flared as if he had smelled something good to eat, and he said,
But now tell me, to satisfy my curiosity, what will you do to this other man when you catch him, this man with whom you have a personal vendetta?
Blow his brains out and snatch his dog, Vince thought. But he knew the kind of crap the screwdriver wanted to hear, the same hard-assed stuff most of these guys wanted to hear from him, their favorite hired killer. So he said, Don Tetragna, I intend to cut off his balls, cut off his ears, cut out his tongue, and only then put an ice pick through his heart and stop his clock. The fat man's eyes glittered with approval. His nostrils flared. Part 3. By Thanksgiving, the outsider had not found the bleached wood house in Big Sur. Every night, Travis and Nora locked the shutters over the inside of the windows. They deadbolted the doors. Retiring to the second floor, they slept with shotguns beside their bed and revolvers on their nightstands. Sometimes, in the dead hours after midnight, they were awakened by strange noises in the yard or on the porch roof. Einstein padded from window to window, sniffing urgently, but always he indicated that they had nothing to fear. On further investigation, Travis usually found a prowling raccoon or other forest creature. Travis enjoyed Thanksgiving more than he had thought he would, given the circumstances. He and Nora cooked an elaborate traditional meal for just the three of them. Roast turkey with chestnut dressing, a clam casserole, glazed carrots, baked corn, pepper slaw, crescent rolls, and pumpkin pie. Einstein sampled everything because he had developed a much more sophisticated palate than an ordinary dog. He was still a dog, however, and though the only thing he strongly disliked was the sour pepper slaw, he preferred turkey above all else. That afternoon he spent a lot of time gnawing contentedly on the drumsticks. Over the weeks, Travis had noticed that, like most dogs, Einstein would go out into the yard occasionally and eat a little grass, though sometimes it seemed to gag him. He did it again on Thanksgiving Day, and when Travis asked him if he liked the taste of grass, Einstein said no.
Then why do you eat it sometimes?
Need it.
Why?
I don't know.
If you don't know what you need it for, then how do you know you need it at all?
Instinct?
Yes.
Just instinct?
Don't knock it.
That evening, the three of them sat in piles of pillows on the living room floor in front of the big stone fireplace listening to music. Einstein's golden coat was glossy and thick in the firelight. As Travis sat with one arm around Nora, petting the dog with his free hand, he thought eating grass must be a good idea because Einstein looked healthy and robust. Einstein sneezed a few times and coughed now and then, but those seemed natural reactions to the Thanksgiving overindulgence and to the warm, dry air in front of the fireplace. Travis was not for a moment concerned about the dog's health.
Part 4.
On the afternoon of Friday, November 26th, the balmy day after Thanksgiving, Garrison Dilworth was aboard his beloved 42-foot Hinckley sou'wester, Amazing Grace, in his boat slip in the Santa Barbara Harbor. He was polishing brightwork, and diligently bent to his task, almost didn't see the two men in business suits as they approached along the dock. He looked up as they were about to announce themselves, and he knew who they were. Not their names, but who they must work for, even before they showed him their credentials. One was named Johnson. The other was Soames. Pretending puzzlement and interest, he invited them aboard. Stepping off the dock, down onto the deck, the one named Johnson said,
"We'd like to ask you a few questions, Mr. Dilworth."
"What about?" Garrison inquired, wiping his hands on a white rag. Johnson was a black man of ordinary size, even a little gaunt, haggard-looking, yet imposing. Garrison said,
"National Security Agency, you say? Surely you don't think I'm in the hire of the KGB?"
Johnson smiled thinly.
"You've done work for Nora Devon?"
He raised his eyebrows.
"Nora? Are you serious? Well, I can assure you that Nora isn't the sort of person to be involved."
"You are her attorney, then?" Johnson asked. Garrison glanced at the freckle-faced younger man, Agent Soames, and again raised his eyebrows as if to ask if Johnson was always this chilly. Soames stared expressionlessly, taking his cue from his boss.
"Oh my, we're in trouble with these two," Garrison thought.
After his frustrating and unsuccessful questioning of Dilworth, Lem sent Cliff Soames off on a series of errands. Begin the procedures to obtain a court order allowing taps to be placed on the attorney's home and office telephones, find the three payphones nearest his office and the three nearest his house, and arrange for taps to be put on those as well. Obtain telephone company records of all long-distance calls made from Dilworth's home and office phones. Bring in extra men from the Los Angeles office to staff an around-the-clock surveillance of Dilworth, starting within 3 hours. While Cliff was attending to those things, Lem strolled around the boat docks in the harbor, hoping the sounds of the sea and the calming sight of rolling water would help clear his mind and focus his thoughts on his problems. God knew he needed desperately to get focused. Over 6 months had passed since the dog and the outsider had escaped from Banodyne, and Lem had lost almost 15 pounds in the pursuit. He had not slept well in months, had little interest in food, and even his sex life had suffered. "There's such a thing as trying too hard," he told himself. "It causes constipation of the mind." But such admonishments did no good. He was still as blocked as a pipe full of concrete. For 3 months since they'd found Cornell's Airstream in the school parking lot the day after Hockney's murder, Lem had known that Cornell and the woman had been returning on that August night from a trip to Vegas, Tahoe, and Monterey. Nightclub table cards from Vegas, hotel stationery, matchbooks, and gasoline credit card receipts had been found in the trailer and pickup truck, pinpointing every stop of their itinerary. He had not known the woman's identity, yet he had assumed she was a girlfriend, nothing more, but of course, he should never have assumed any such thing. Only a few days ago, when one of his own agents went to Vegas to marry, Lem had finally realized that Cornell and the woman could have gone to Vegas for the same purpose. Suddenly, their trip had looked like a honeymoon. Within hours, he confirmed that Cornell had, in fact, been married in Clark County, Nevada, on August 11th, to Nora Devon of Santa Barbara. seeking the woman, he discovered that her house had been sold 6 weeks ago, after she'd vanished with Cornell. Looking into the sale, he found she'd been represented by her attorney, Garrison Dilworth. By freezing Cornell's assets, Lem thought he had made it harder for the man to continue a fugitive existence. But now he discovered that Dilworth had helped to slip $20,000 out of Cornell's bank, and that all of the proceeds from the sale of the woman's house had been transferred to her somehow. Furthermore, through Dilworth, she had closed out her local bank accounts 4 weeks ago, and that money was also in her hands. She and her husband and the dog might now have sufficient resources to remain in hiding for years. Standing on the dock, Lem stared at the sun-spangled sea, which slapped rhythmically against the pilings. The motion nauseated him. He looked up at the soaring, cawing seagulls. Instead of being calmed by their graceful flight, he grew edgy. Garrison Dilworth was intelligent, clever, a born fighter. Now that the link had been made between him and the Cornells, the attorney promised to take the NSA to court to unfreeze Travis's assets. "You filed no charges against the man," Dilworth had said. "What toadying judge would grant the power to freeze his accounts? Your manipulation of the legal system to hamper an innocent citizen is unconscionable." Lem could have filed charges against Travis and Nora Cornell for the violation of all sorts of laws designed to preserve the national security, and by doing so, he'd have made it impossible for Dilworth to continue lending assistance to the fugitives. But filing charges meant attracting media attention. Then the harebrained story about Cornell's pet panther, and perhaps the NSA's entire cover-up, would come down like a paper house in a thunderstorm. His only hope was that Dilworth would try to get in touch with the Cornells to tell them that his association with them had been at last uncovered and that contact between them would have to be far more circumspect in the future. Then, with luck, Lem would pinpoint the Cornells through their telephone number. He did not have much hope of everything working out that easily. Dilworth was no fool. Looking around at the Santa Barbara yacht harbor, Lem tried to relax, for he knew he needed to be calm and fresh if he was to outthink the old attorney. The hundreds of pleasure boats at the docks, sails furled or packed away, bobbed gently on the rolling tide, and other boats with unfurled sails glided serenely out toward the open sea, and people in bathing suits were sunning on the decks or having early cocktails, and the gulls darted like stitching needles across the blue and white quilt of the sky, and people were fishing from the stone breakwater, and the scene was achingly picturesque, but it was also an image of leisure, great and calculated leisure, to which Lem Johnson could not identify. To Lem, too much leisure was a dangerous distraction from the cold, hard realities of life, from the competitive world, and any leisure activity that lasted longer than a few hours made him nervous and anxious to get back to work. Here was leisure measured in days, in weeks. Here, in these expensive and lovingly crafted boats, was leisure measured in month-long sailing excursions up and down the coast. So much leisure that it made Lem break into a sweat, made him want to scream. He had the outsider to worry about as well. There had been no sign of it since the day Travis Cornell had shot at it in his rented house, back at the end of August, 3 months ago. What had the thing been doing in those 3 months? Where had it been hiding? Was it still after the dog? Was it dead? Maybe out in the wilds it had been bitten by a rattlesnake. Or maybe it had fallen off a cliff. God, Lem thought, let it be dead. Please, give me that much of a break. Let it be dead. But he knew the outsider was not dead, because that would be too easy. Nothing in life was that easy. The damn thing was out there, stalking the dog. It had probably suppressed the urge to kill people it encountered because it knew each murder drew Lem and his men closer to it, and it did not want to be found before it had killed the dog. When the beast had torn the dog and the Cornells to bloody pieces, then it would once again begin to vent its rage on the population at large, and every death would hang heavily on Lem Johnson's conscience. Meanwhile, the investigation into the murders of the Banodyne scientists was dead in the water. In fact, that second NSA task force had been dismantled. Obviously, the Soviets had hired outsiders for those hits, and there was no way to find out whom they had brought in. A deeply tanned guy in white shorts and topsiders passed Lem and said, "Beautiful day."
"Like hell," Lem said.
Part 5. The day after Thanksgiving, Travis walked into the kitchen to get a glass of milk and saw Einstein having a sneezing fit, but he did not think much of it. Nora, even quicker than Travis to worry about the retriever's welfare, was also unconcerned. In California, the pollen counts peak in spring and autumn. However, because the climate permits a 12-month cycle of flowers, no season is pollen-free. Living in the woods, the situation was exacerbated. That night, Travis was awakened by a sound he could not identify. Instantly alert, every trace of sleep banished, he sat up in the dark and reached for the shotgun on the floor beside the bed. Holding the Mossberg, he listened for the noise, and in a minute or so it came again, in the second-floor hallway. He eased out of bed without waking Nora and went cautiously to the doorway. The hall, like most places in the house, was equipped with a low-wattage nightlight. In the pale glow, Travis saw that the noise came from the dog. Einstein was standing near the head of the stairs, coughing and shaking his head. Travis went to him, and the retriever looked up. "You okay?" A quick wag of the tail. "Yes." He stooped and ruffled the dog's coat. "You sure?" "Yes." For a minute, the dog pressed against him, enjoying being petted. Then he turned away from Travis, coughed a couple of times, and went downstairs. Travis followed. In the kitchen, he found Einstein slurping water from the dish. Having emptied the dish, the retriever went to the pantry, turned on the light, and began to paw lettered tiles out of the lucite tubes. "Thirsty." "Are you sure you feel well?" "Fine, just thirsty. Nightmare woke me." Surprised, Travis said, "You dream?" "Don't you?" "Yeah, too much." He refilled the retriever's water dish, and Einstein emptied it again, and Travis filled it a second time. By then the dog had had enough. Travis expected him to want to go outside to pee, but the dog went upstairs instead and settled in the hall by the door of the bedroom in which Nora still slept. In a whisper, Travis said, "Listen, if you want to come in and sleep beside the bed, it's all right." That was what Einstein wanted. He curled up on the floor on Travis's side of the bed. In the dark, Travis could reach out and easily touch both the shotgun and Einstein. He took greater reassurance from the presence of the dog than from the gun. Part 6. Saturday afternoon, just 2 days after Thanksgiving, Garrison Dilworth got in his Mercedes and drove slowly away from his house. Within 2 blocks, he confirmed that the NSA still had a tail on him. It was a green Ford, probably the same one that had followed him last evening. They stayed well back of him, and they were discreet, but he was not blind. He still had not called Nora and Travis. Because he was being followed, he suspected his phones were being tapped as well. He could have gone to a payphone, but he was afraid that the NSA could eavesdrop on the conversation with a directional microphone or some other high-tech gadget. And if they managed to record the push-button tones that he produced by punching in the Cornell's number, they could easily translate those tones into digits and trace the number back to Big Sur. He would have to resort to deception to contact Travis and Nora safely. He knew he had better act soon, before Travis or Nora phoned him. These days, with the technology available to them, the NSA could trace the call back to its origins as fast as Garrison would be able to warn Travis that the line was tapped. So at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon, chaperoned by the green Ford, he drove to Della Colby's house in Montecito to take her to his boat, the Amazing Grace, for a lazy afternoon in the sun. At least, that was what he had told her on the phone. Della was Judge Jack Colby's widow. She and Jack were Garrison and Francine's best friends for 25 years before death broke up the foresome. Jack had died 1 year after Francine. Della and Garrison remained very close. They frequently went to dinner together, went dancing and walking and sailing. Initially, their relationship had been strictly platonic. They were simply old friends who had the fortune, or misfortune, to outlast everyone they most cared about. And they needed each other because they shared so many good times and memories that would be diminished when there was no longer anyone left with whom to reminisce. A year ago, when they suddenly found themselves in bed together, They'd been surprised and overwhelmed with guilt. They felt as if they were cheating on their spouses, though Jack and Francine had died years ago. The guilt passed, of course, and now they were grateful for the companionship and gently burning passion that had unexpectedly brightened their late autumn years. When he pulled into Della's driveway, she came out of the house, locked the front door, and hurried to his car. She was dressed in boat shoes, white slacks, a blue and white striped sweater, and a blue windbreaker. Although she was 69, and though her short hair was snow white, she looked 15 years younger. He got out of the Mercedes, gave her a hug and a kiss, and said, "Can we go in your car?" She blinked. "Are you having trouble with yours?" "No," he said. "I'd just rather take yours."
"Sure."
She backed her caddy out of the garage, and he got in on the passenger side. As she pulled into the street, he said, "I'm afraid my car might be bugged, and I don't want them hearing what I've got to tell you." Her expression was priceless. Laughing, he said, "No, I've not gone senile overnight. If you'll keep an eye in the rearview mirror as you drive, you'll see we're being followed. They're very good, very subtle, but they're not invisible." He gave her time, and after a few blocks, Della said,
"The green Ford, is it?"
"That's them."
"What have you gotten yourself into, dear?"
"Don't go straight to the harbor. Drive to the farmer's market, and we'll buy some fresh fruit. Then drive to a liquor store, and we'll buy some wine. By then, I'll have told you everything."
"Have you some secret life I've never suspected?"
she asked, grinning at him.
"Are you a geriatric James Bond?"
Yesterday, Lem Johnson had reopened a temporary headquarters in a claustrophobic office at the Santa Barbara courthouse. The room had one narrow window. The walls were dark, and the overhead lighting fixture was so dim it left the corners full of hanging shadows like misplaced scarecrows. The borrowed furniture consisted of rejects from other offices. He had worked out of here in the days following the Hockney killing, but had closed it up after a week, when there was nothing more to be done in the area. Now, with the hope that Dilworth would lead them to the Cornells, Lem reopened the cramped field HQ, plugged in the phones, and waited for developments. He shared the office with one assisting agent, Jim Vaughn, who was an almost too earnest and too dedicated 25-year-old. At the moment, Cliff Soames was in charge of the 6-man team at the harbor, overseeing not only the NSA agents spotted throughout the area, but also coordinating the coverage of Garrison Dilworth with the Harbor Patrol and the Coast Guard. The shrewd old man apparently realized he was being followed, so Lem expected him to make a break, to try to shake surveillance long enough to place a call to the Cornells in private. The most logical way for Garrison to throw off his tail was to head out to sea, go up or down the coast, put ashore on a launch, and telephone Cornell before his pursuers could relocate him. But he would be surprised to find himself accompanied out of the harbor by the local patrol. Then at sea, he would be followed by a Coast Guard cutter standing by for that purpose. At 3:40, Cliff called to report that Dilworth and his lady friend were sitting on the deck of the Amazing Grace, eating fruit and sipping wine, reminiscing a lot, laughing a little. "From what we can pick up with directional microphones and from what we can see, I'd say they don't have any intention of going anywhere, except maybe to bed. They sure do seem to be a randy old pair." "Stay with them," Lem said. "I don't trust him." Another call came through from the search team that had secretly entered Dilworth's house minutes after he had left. They had found nothing related to the Cornells or the dog. Dilworth's office had been carefully searched last night, and nothing had been found there either. Likewise, a study of his phone records did not produce a number for the Cornells. If he had called them in the past, he always did so from a payphone. An examination of his AT&T credit card records showed no such calls, so if he had used a payphone, he had not billed it to himself, but had reversed the charges to the Cornells, leaving nothing to be traced, which was not a good sign. Obviously, Dilworth had been exceedingly cautious even before he had known he was being watched. Saturday, afraid the dog might be coming down with a cold, Travis kept an eye on Einstein. But the retriever sneezed only a couple of times and did not cough at all, and he seemed to be fit. A freight company delivered 10 large cartons containing all of Nora's finished canvases that had been left behind in Santa Barbara. A couple of weeks ago, using a friend's return address to ensure that no link would exist between him and Nora Ames, Garrison Dilworth had shipped the paintings to their new house. Now, unpacking and unwrapping the canvases, creating piles of paper padding in the living room, Nora was transported. Travis knew that for many years, this work was what she had lived for, and he could see that having the paintings with her again was not only a great joy to her, but would probably spur her to return to her new canvases in the spare bedroom with greater enthusiasm.
"You want to call Garrison and thank him?" he asked.
"Yes, absolutely," she said. "But first, let's unpack them all and make sure none of them is damaged."
Posted around the harbor, posing as yacht owners and fishermen, Cliff Soames and the other NSA agents watched Dilworth and Della Colby and eavesdropped on them electronically as the day waned. Twilight descended, and without any indication that Dilworth intended to put to sea. Soon night fell, yet the attorney and his woman made no move. Half an hour after dark, Cliff Soames got weary of pretending to fish off the stern of a Choi Lee 66-foot sport yacht docked four slips away from Dilworth's. He climbed the steps, went into the pilot's cabin, and pulled the headphones off Hank Gorner, the agent who was monitoring the old couple's conversation through a directional mic. He listened for himself.
"The time in Acapulco when Jack hired that fishing boat.
Yes, the whole crew looked like pirates. We thought we'd have our throats cut, be dumped at sea. But then it turned out they were all divinity students, studying to be missionaries, and Jack said..."
Returning the headphones, Cliff said,
"Still reminiscing."
The other agent nodded. The cabin light was out, and Hank was illuminated only by a small, hooded, built-in work lamp above the chart table, so his features looked elongated and strange.
"That's the way it's been all day. At least they have some great stories."
"I'm going to the John," Cliff said wearily.
"Be right back. Take 10 hours if you want. They're not going anywhere."
A few minutes later, when Cliff returned, Hank Gorner pulled off his headphones and said,
"They went below decks."
"Something up?"
"Not what we'd hope. They're going to jump each other's bones."
"Oh.
Cliff, geez, I don't want to listen to this."
"Listen," Cliff insisted.
Hank put one earphone to his head.
"Geez, they're undressing each other. They're as old as my grandparents. This is embarrassing."
Cliff sighed.
"Now they're quiet,"
Hank said, a frown of distaste creeping over his face.
"Any second they're going to start moaning, Cliff."
"Listen," Cliff insisted.
He snatched a light jacket off the table and went outside again so he wouldn't have to listen. He took up his position in a chair on the stern deck, lifting the fishing pole once more. The night was cool enough for the jacket, but otherwise it could not have been better. The air was clear and sweet, scented with just a slight tang of the sea. The moonless sky was full of stars. The water slapped lullingly against the dock pilings and against the hulls of the moored boats. Somewhere across the harbor, on another craft, someone was playing love songs from the '40s. An engine turned over. Womp, womp, womp. And there was something romantic about the sound. Cliff thought how nice it would be to own a boat and set out on a long trip through the South Pacific, toward palm-shaded islands. Suddenly that idling engine roared, and Cliff realized it was the Amazing Grace. As he rose from his chair, dropping the fishing pole, he saw Dilworth's boat reversing out of its slip recklessly fast. It was a sailboat, and subconsciously Cliff had not expected it to move with sails furled. But it had auxiliary engines. They knew this, were prepared for this. But still, it startled him. He hurried back to the cabin.
"Hank, get Harbor Patrol. Dilworth's on the move."
"But they're in the sack. Like hell they are."
Cliff ran out to the bow deck and saw that Dilworth had already swung the Amazing Grace around and was headed toward the mouth of the harbor. No lights at the aft end of the boat, the area around the wheel, just one small light forward.
Jesus. He was really making a break for it.
By the time they unpacked all 100 canvases, hung a few, and carried the rest into the unused bedroom, they were starving.
"Garrison's probably having dinner now, too," Nora said. "I don't want to interrupt him. Let's call him after we've eaten."
In the pantry, Einstein released letters from the Lucite tubes and spelled out a message. "It's dark. Close the shutters first." Surprised and unsettled by his own uncharacteristic inattention to security, Travis hurried from room to room, closing the interior shutters and slipping the bolt-type latches in place. Fascinated by Nora's paintings
and delighted by the pleasures she exhibited in their arrival, he had not even noticed that night had arrived. Halfway toward the mouth of the harbor, confident that distance and the engine's roar now protected them from electronic eavesdroppers, Garrison said, "Take me close to the outer point of the North Breakwater along the channel's edge."
"Are you sure about this?" Della asked worriedly. "You're not a teenager."
He patted her bottom and said, "I'm better.
Dreamer."
He kissed her on the cheek and edged forward along the starboard railing, where he got into position for his jump. He was wearing dark blue swim trunks. He should have had a wetsuit because the water would be chilly. But he thought he ought to be able to swim to the breakwater, around the point of it, and haul himself out in the north side, out of sight of the harbor, all in a few minutes, long before the water temperature leached too much body heat from him.
"Company!"
Della called from the wheel. He looked back and saw a harbor patrol boat leaving the docks to the south, coming toward them on their port side. "They won't stop us," he thought. "They have no legal right." But he had to go over the side before the patrol swung in and took up a position astern. From behind, they would see him vault the railing. As long as they were to port, the Amazing Grace would conceal his departure, and the boat's phosphorescent wake would cover the first few seconds of his swim around the point of the breakwater, long enough for the patrol's attention to have moved on with Della. They were heading out at the highest speed with which Della felt comfortable. The Hinkley Sou'wester jolted through the slightly choppy waters with enough force to make it necessary for Garrison to hold fast to the railing. Still, they seemed to move past the stone wall of the breakwater at a frustratingly slow pace, and the harbor patrol drew nearer. But Garrison waited, waited, because he didn't want to go into the harbor 100 yards short of its end. If he went in too soon, he would not be able to swim all the way out to the point and around it. Instead, he would have to swim straight to the breakwater and climb its flank, within full sight of all observers. Now the patrol closed to within 100 yards. He could see them when he rose from a crouch and looked across the Hinkley's cabin roof and began to swing around behind them. And Garrison could not wait much longer. Could not.
"The point!"
Della called from the wheel. He threw himself over the railing, into the dark water, away from the boat. The sea was cold. It shocked the breath out of him. He sank, could not feel the surface, was seized by panic, flailed, thrashed, but then broke through to the air, gasping. The Amazing Grace was surprisingly close. He felt as if he had been thrashing in confusion beneath the surface for a minute or more. But it must have only been a second or two, because his boat was not yet far away. The harbor patrol was close too, and he decided that even the churning wake of the Amazing Grace did not give him enough cover. So he took a deep breath and went under again, staying down as long as he could. When he came up, both Della and her shadowers were well past the mouth of the harbor, turning south, and he was safe from observation. The outgoing tide was swiftly carrying him past the point of the northern breakwater, which was a wall of loose boulders and rocks that rose more than 20 feet above the waterline, mottled gray and black ramparts in the night. He not only had to swim around the end of that barrier, but had to move toward land against the resistant current. Without further delay, he began to swim, wondering why on earth he had thought this would be a snap. "They're almost 71, he told himself, as he stroked past the rocky point, which was illuminated by a navigation warning light. "Whatever possessed you to play hero?" But he knew what possessed him. A deep-seated belief that the dog must remain free, that it must not be treated as the government's property. If we've come so far that we can create as God creates, then we have to learn to act with the justice and mercy of God. That was what he had told Nora and Travis and Einstein on the night Ted Hockney had been killed, and he had meant every word he'd said. Salt water stung his eyes, blurred his vision. Some had gotten into his mouth, and it burned a small ulcer on his lower lip. He fought the current, pulled past the point of the breakwater, out of sight of the harbor, and slashed toward the rocks. Reaching them at last, he hung on to the first boulder he touched, gasping, not yet quite able to pull himself out of the water. In the intervening weeks since Nora and Travis went on the run, Garrison had plenty of time to think about Einstein, and he felt even more strongly that to imprison an intelligent creature, innocent of all crime, was an act of grave injustice, regardless of whether the prisoner was a dog. Garrison had devoted his life to the pursuit of justice that was made possible by the laws of a democracy, and to the maintenance of the freedom that grew from this justice. When a man of ideals decides he is too old to risk everything for what he believes in, then he is no longer a man of ideals. He may no longer be a man at all. That hard truth had driven him, in spite of his age, to make this night swim. Funny that a long life of idealism should, after 7 decades, be put to the ultimate test over the fate of a dog. But what a dog! And what a wondrous new world we live in, he thought. Genetic technology might have been rechristened genetic art, for every work of art was an act of creation, and no act of creation was finer or more beautiful than the creation of an intelligent mind. Getting his second wind, he heaved entirely out of the water, onto the sloped north flank of the northern breakwater. That barrier rose between him and the harbor, and he moved inland along the rocks, while the sea surged to his left side. He'd brought a waterproof penlight, clipped to his trunks, and now he used it to proceed barefoot with the greatest caution, afraid of slipping on the wet stones and breaking a leg or an ankle. He could see the city lights a few hundred yards ahead, and the vague silvery line of the beach. He was cold, but not as cold as he had been in the water. His heart was beating fast, but not as fast as before. He was going to make it. Lem Johnson drove down from the temporary HQ in the courthouse, and Cliff met him at the empty boat slip where the Amazing Grace had been tied up. A wind had risen. Hundreds of crafts along the dock were wallowing slightly in their berths. They creaked, and slack sail lines clicked and clinked against their masts. Dock lamps and neighboring boat lanterns cast shimmering patterns of light on the dark, oily-looking water where Dilworth's 42-footer had been moored.
"Harbor patrol?"
Lem asked worriedly.
They followed him out to open sea. Seemed as if he was going to turn north, swung close by the point, but then he went south instead.
Did Dilworth see them?
He had to. As you see, no fog, lots of stars, clear as a bell.
Good. I want him to be aware. Coast Guard?
I've talked to the cutter, Cliff assured him. They're on the spot, flanking the Amazing Grace at 100 yards, heading south along the coast.
Shivering in the rapidly cooling air, Lem said,
They know he might try putting ashore in a rubber boat or whatever?
They know, Cliff said. He can't do it under their noses.
Is the guard sure he sees them?
They're lit up like a Christmas tree.
Good. I want him to know it's hopeless. If we can just keep him from warning the Cornells, then they'll call him sooner or later, and we'll have them. Even if they call him from a payphone, we'll know their general location.
In addition to taps on Dilworth's home and office phones, the NSA had installed tracing equipment that would lock open a line the moment a connection was made, and keep it open even after both parties hung up, until the caller's number and street address were ascertained and verified. Even if Dilworth shouted a warning and hung up the instant he recognized one of the Cornell's voices, it would be too late. The only way he could try to foil the NSA was by not answering his phone at all. But even that would do him no good, because after the 6th ring, every incoming call was being automatically answered by the NSA's equipment, which opened the line and began tracing procedures.
The only thing that could screw us now, Lem said, is if Dilworth gets to a phone we don't have monitored and warns the Cornells not to call him.
It's not going to happen, Cliff said. We're on him tight.
I wish you wouldn't say that, Lem worried.
As the wind got hold of it, a metal clip on a loose line clanged loudly off a spar, and the sound made Lem jump.
My dad always said the worst happens when you least expect it.
Cliff shook his head.
With all due respect, sir, the more I hear you quote your father, the more I think he must have been just about the gloomiest man who ever lived.
Looking around at the wallowing boats and wind-chopped water, feeling as if he was moving instead of standing still in a moving world, a little queasy, Lem said,
Yeah, my dad was a great guy in his way, but he was also impossible.
Hank Gorner shouted,
Hey!
He was running along the dock from the Choi Lee where he and Cliff had been stationed all day.
I've just been on with the guard cutter. They're playing their searchlight over the Amazing Grace, intimidating a little. They tell me they don't see Dilworth, just the woman.
Lem said,
But Christ, he's running the boat.
No, Gorner said. There's no lights in the Amazing Grace, but the guard's searchlight brightens up the whole thing. and they say the woman's at the wheel.
That's all right, he's just below deck, Cliff said.
No, Lem said, as his heart started to pound. He wouldn't be below deck at a time like this. He'd be studying the cutter, deciding whether to keep going or turn back. He's not on the Amazing Grace. But he has to be. He didn't get off before she pulled out of the dock.
Lem stared out across the crystalline clear harbor, toward the light near the end of the northern breakwater.
You said the damn boat swung out close to the north point, and it looked as if he was going north, but then he suddenly swung south.
Shit, Cliff said.
That's where he dropped off, Lem said. Out by the point of the northern breakwater, without a rubber boat. Swimming, by God!
He's too old for that crap, Cliff protested.
Evidently not. He went around the other side and he's headed for a phone on one of the northern public beaches. We've got to stop him, and fast!
Cliff cupped his hands to his mouth and shouted the first names of the four agents who were positioned on other boats along the docks. His voice carried, echoing flatly off the water in spite of the wind. Men came running, and even as Cliff's shouts faded away across the harbor, Lem was sprinting for his car in the parking lot.
The worst happens when you least expect it.
As Travis was rinsing dinner dishes, Nora said, "Look at this." He turned and saw that she was standing by Einstein's food and water dishes. The water was gone, but half his dinner remained. She said, "When have you known him to leave a single scrap?"
"Never."
Frowning, Travis wiped his hands on the kitchen towel. "The last few days I've thought maybe he's coming down with a cold or something, but he says he feels fine. And today he hasn't been sneezing or coughing like he was." They went into the living room, where the retriever was reading Black Beauty with the help of his page-turning machine. They knelt beside him, and he looked up, and Nora said, "Are you sick, Einstein?" The retriever barked once, softly.
"No."
"Are you sure?" A quick wag of the tail.
"Yes."
"You didn't finish your dinner,"
Travis said. The dog yawned elaborately. Nora said, "Are you telling us you're a little tired?"
"Yes."
"If you were feeling ill," Travis said, "you'd let us know right away, wouldn't you, Furface?"
"Yes."
Nora insisted on examining Einstein's eyes, mouth, and ears for obvious signs of infection. But at last she said,
"Nothing. He seems okay.
I guess even Superdog has a right to be tired once in a while."
The wind had come up fast. It was chilly, and under its lash the waves rose higher than they had been all day. A mass of goose flesh, Garrison reached the landwater end of the north flank of the harbor's northern breakwater. He was relieved to depart the hard and sometimes jagged stones of that rampart for the sandy beach. He was sure he had scraped and cut both feet. They felt hot, and his left foot stung with each step, forcing him to limp. He stayed close to the surf, away from the tree-lined park that lay behind the beach. Over there, where park lamps lit the walkways and where spotlights dramatically highlighted the palms, he would be more easily seen from the street. He did not think anyone would be looking for him. He was sure his trick had worked. However, if anyone was looking for him, he did not want to call attention to himself. The gusting wind tore foam off the incoming breakers and flung it in Garrison's face, so he felt as if he was continuously running through spider's webs. The stuff stung his eyes, which had finally stopped tearing from his dunk in the sea, and at last he was forced to move away from the surf line, farther up the beach, where the softer sand met the lawn, but where he was still out of the lights. Young people were on the darkish beach, dressed for the chill of the night, couples on blankets cuddling, small groups smoking dope, listening to music. 8 or 10 teenage boys were gathered around 2 all-terrain vehicles with balloon tires, which were not allowed on the beach during the day, and most likely weren't allowed at night. They were drinking beer beside a pit they dug in the sand to bury their bottles if they saw a cop approaching. They were talking loudly about girls and indulging in horseplay. No one gave Garrison more than a glance as he hurried by. In California, health food and exercise fanatics were as common as street muggers in New York. And if an old man wanted to take a cold swim and then run on the beach in the dark, he was no more remarkable or noteworthy than a priest in a church. As he headed north, Garrison scanned the park to his right in search of payphones. They would probably be in pairs, prominently illuminated, on islands of concrete beside one of the walkways, or perhaps near one of the public comfort stations. He was beginning to despair, certain that he must have passed at least one group of telephones, that his old eyes were failing him. But then he saw what he was looking for. Two payphones with wing-like sound shields, brightly lighted. They were about 100 feet in from the beach, midway between the sand and the street that flanked the other side of the park. Turning his back to the churning sea, he slowed to catch his breath and walked across the grass, under the wind-shaken fronds of a cluster of 3 stately royal palms. He was still 40 feet from the phones when he saw a car, traveling at high speed, suddenly brake and pull to the curb with a squeal of tires, parking in a direct line from the phones. Garrison didn't know who they were, but he decided not to take any chances. He sidled into the cover provided by a huge old double-bowled date palm that was, fortunately, not one of those fitted with decorative spotlights. From the notch between the trunks, he had a view of the phones and of the walkway leading out to the curb where the car had parked. 2 men got out of the sedan. 1 sprinted north along the park perimeter, looking inward, searching for something. The other man rushed straight into the park along the walkway. When he reached the lighted area around the phones, his identity was clear and shocking. Lemuel Johnson. Behind the trunks of the Siamese date palms, Garrison drew his arms and legs closer to his body, sure that the joined bases of the trees provided him with plenty of cover, but trying to make himself smaller nevertheless. Johnson went to the first phone, lifted the handset, and tried to tear it out of the coin box. It had one of those flexible metal cords, and he yanked on it hard, repeatedly, with little effect. Finally, cursing the instrument's toughness, he ripped the handset loose and threw it across the park. Then he destroyed the second phone. For a moment, as Johnson turned away from the phones and walked straight toward Garrison, the attorney thought that he had been seen. But Johnson stopped after only a few steps and scanned the seaward end of the park and the beach beyond. His gaze did not appear to rest even momentarily on the date palms behind which Garrison hid. "You damn crazy old bastard," Johnson said, then hurried back to his car. Crouched in shadows behind the palms, Garrison grinned, because he knew whom the NSA man was talking about. Suddenly the attorney did not mind the chill wind sweeping off the night sea behind him. "Damn crazy old bastard, or geriatric James Bond, take your pick. Either way, he was still a man to be reckoned with." In the basement switching room of the telephone company, agents Rick Olbier and Denny Jones were tending the NSA's electronic tapping and tracing equipment, monitoring Garrison Dilworth's office and home lines. It was dull duty, and they played cards to make the time pass. 2-hand pinochle and 500 rummy, neither of which was a good game, but the very idea of 2-hand poker repelled them. When a call came through to Dilworth's home number at 8:14, Olbier and Jones reacted with far more excitement than the situation warranted because they were desperate for action. Olbier dropped his cards on the floor, and Jones threw his on the table, and they reached for the 2 headsets as if this was World War II, and they were expecting to overhear a top-secret conversation between Hitler and Goering. Their equipment was set to open the line and lock in a tracer pulse if Dilworth did not answer by the 6th ring. Because he knew the attorney was not at home and that the phone would not be answered, Olbier overrode the program and opened the line after the 2nd ring. On the computer screen, green letters announced, "Now tracing." And on the open line, a man said, "Hello?" "Hello?" Jones said into the mic on his headset. The caller's number and his local Santa Barbara address appeared on the screen. This system worked much like the 911 police emergency computer, providing instant identification of the caller. But now, above the address on the screen, a company's rather than an individual's name appeared. Telephone Solicitations Incorporated. On the line, responding to Denny Jones, the caller said, "Sir, I'm pleased to tell you that you have been selected to receive a free 8x10 photograph and 10 free pocket prints of any..." Jones said, "Who is this?" The computer was now searching databanks of Santa Barbara street addresses to cross-check the ID of the caller. The voice on the phone said, "Well, I'm calling in behalf of Olin Mills, sir, the photography studio, where the finest quality..." "Wait a sec," Jones said. The computer verified the identity of the telephone subscriber who placed the call. Dilworth was getting a sales pitch,
Nothing more.
I don't want any,
Jones said sharply and disconnected.
Shit,
Olbier said. Binocle? Jones said.